Welcome to another edition of Five of the Best. This one is about five events that happened in 1982. There was some crazy stuff happening in 1982. One that caught my eye was when Michael Fagan in 1982 broke into the house to Buckingham Palace, and he made it all the way to the Queen's bedroom, where he had a short conversation with her, asking for a pack of fags before she strolled out looking for security guards. But that's the 80s for you. In 1982, we saw one of my favourite films, E.T. No, Blade Runner. The film was directed by Ridley Scott, who just finished the rather slow-paced Dune, and he was looking for something a bit more faster-paced. The story was based on a Philip K. Dick's 1968 novel, Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? But the name of the film comes from another sci-fi book, Blade Runner, by K. Norse, and Ridley Scott liked the name, so he bought up the rights for the book. When the screen plot was written, it was written for Robert Mitchum to play Decker, but when Ridley Scott came in, he had other ideas, and he had serious talks with Dustin Hoffman, but Dustin Hoffman walked away after differences in the way the film was going, which left the door open for Harrison Ford, who had just finished Indiana Jones. But other actors which were seriously considered for the part were Gene Hackman, Jack Nicholson, and Burt Reynolds. Two lesser known actors played some major parts in the film. One was Daryl Hannah, who played Pris, and the other one was Sean Young, who played Rachel. One actor who did not have to audition, he was just sent the script and he agreed to do the film, was Ruud Koopmans. The plot of the script is that Decker is a Blade Runner who tracks down and terminates four replicants who return to Earth who are seeking their maker. When it was released, big things were expected from it, and it opened in 1200 theatres, and it took a rather disappointing $6 million, that compared to Star Trek 2, which took $40 million. I mean, it was up against some really classic films at the time, like E.T. was released at almost at the same time, French Lieutenant's Woman, and Chariots of Fire, and there's another big film which was released. Anyway, in the end, the whole project was made for $28 million, and in the box office it took $33 million, making a profit of, what's that, $5 million. In 1982, we saw the 33rd edition of the Formula One Grand Prix season, and there was a main technical change here with the allowance of turbocharging of the engines, which offered a significant advantage over the normally aspirated lower aspirated engines. But this came at an expense, and only the bigger teams could afford it, such as Ferrari, Brabham, McLaren and Renault. In 1982, we saw Niki Lauda come back into Formula One after a two-year absence. He would partner John Watson in the McLaren. Many people thought that he came back just to prop up his failing airline, and he was being paid nearly $3 million for the year. One of the other competitors was the speedy Frenchman Alain Prost, who was entering his second year, and he would be driving a Renault, and defending champion Nelson Piquet driving a Brabham. The two Ferraris would be driven by Didier Pironi and Gilles Villeneuve. And the one other major competitor would be Keke Rosberg, who would be driving the naturally aspirated Williams. When the season started, it's clear that if you had a turbocharged engine, you had a chance of winning the Grand Prix. The first two Grand Prix was won by Alain Prost in his Renault, and Niki Lauda won one race, and Didier Pironi in a Ferrari won the second. But coming into the fifth race, we saw a major fatality in the Belgian Grand Prix when Gilles Villeneuve was killed. He was passing a slower car and he clipped it, and his car was thrown up into the air, flew 100 metres, and although he was taken to hospital, he died in hospital the next day. Didier Pironi, who was withdrawn from the race, and By mid-season, it was clear that if you had a turbocharged engine, you had a chance of winning the championship, as if you finished the race. Nelson Piquet, the world champion, managed to win one race, but only finished two of the next eight races. Alain Prost, after winning the first two races, only managed to finish one of the next seven. And it was just technical difficulties with the cars. The turbocharged engines were just simply too fragile. And with the table, mid-season table looking like this, John Watson driving the turbocharged McLaren was winning with 26 points. Didier Pironi in the Ferrari is 20. Alain Prost in the Renault 18, and Keke Rosberg in the naturally aspirated Williams 17. The next five races, Niki Lauda won one, Didier Pironi another, and Rene Arnoux the next. Just leaving Didier Pironi a nice healthy 7 point lead coming into the German Grand Prix. Didier Pironi took pole position in his Ferrari, but after that he went testing on new tyres, and there was a very similar accident to the Gilles Villeneuve, with Pironi clipping Alain Prost and having a serious accident. But he survived the accident, suffering just two broken legs. He actually had a 9 point lead over John Watson at the time, and he did not complete any of the remaining five races. He had a 39 point lead with John Watson 30. With three races to go, he was still in the lead by 6 points, but that was about to change when Keke Rosberg won the Swiss Grand Prix, making him virtually unbeatable with two races to go. In fact, he did become a world champion with a title of 44 points. Pironi was second at 39 and John Watson third at 38. Although it must have been a very hollow victory, because if Didier Pironi had managed to win any of the races, he would have surely scored more than 5 points in the last five races. It's very much like a tale of the tortoise and the hare, with a naturally aspirated Williams winning over the turbocharge. In fact, Keke Rosberg only failed to finish in three races. In 1982, we saw the 33rd edition of the Formula One Grand Prix season, and there was a main technical change here with the allowance of turbocharging of the engines, which offered a significant advantage over the normally aspirated lower aspirated engines. But this came at an expense, and only the bigger teams could afford it, such as Ferrari, Brabham, McLaren and Renault. In 1982, we saw Niki Lauda come back into Formula One after a two-year absence. He would partner John Watson in the McLaren. Many people thought that he came back just to prop up his failing airline, and he was being paid nearly $3 million for the year. One of the other competitors was the speedy Frenchman Alain Prost, who was entering his second year, and he would be driving a Renault. And defending champion Nelson Piquet, driving a Brabham. The two Ferraris would be driven by Didier Pironi and Gilles Villeneuve. And the one other major competitor would be Keke Rosberg, who would be driving the naturally aspirated Williams. When the season started, it's clear that if you had a turbocharged engine, you had a chance of winning the Grand Prix. The first two Grand Prix was won by Alain Prost in his Renault, and Niki Lauda won one race, and Didier Pironi in a Ferrari won the second. But coming into the fifth race, we saw a major fatality in the Belgian Grand Prix when Gilles Villeneuve was killed. He was passing a slower car and he clipped it, and his car was thrown up into the air, flew 100 metres, and although he was taken to hospital, he died in hospital the next day. Didier Pironi, who was withdrawn from the race, and by mid-season, it was clear that if you had a turbocharged engine, you had a chance of winning the championship, as if you finished the race. Nelson Piquet, the world champion, and managed to win one race, but only finished two of the next eight races. Alan Prost, after winning the first two races, only managed to finish one of the next seven. And it was just technical difficulties with the cars. The turbocharged engines were just simply too fragile. And with the table, mid-season table looking like this, John Watson driving the turbocharged McLaren was winning with 26 points. Didier Pironi in the Ferrari is 20. Alain Prost in the Renault 18, and Keke Rosberg in the naturally aspirated Williams 17. The next five races, Niki Lauda won one, Didier Pironi another, and René Arnoux the next. Just leaving Didier Pironi a nice healthy 7-point lead coming into the German Grand Prix. Coming to the German Grand Prix, Didier Pironi took pole position in his Ferrari, but after that he went testing on new tyres, and there was a very similar accident to the Gilles Villeneuve, with Pironi clipping Alain Prost and having a serious accident, but he survived the accident, suffering just two broken legs. He actually had a 9-point lead over John Watson at the time, and he did not complete any of the remaining five races. He had a 39-point lead with John Watson 30. With three races to go, he was still in the lead by 6 points, but that was about to change when Keke Rosberg won the Swiss Grand Prix, making him virtually unbeatable with two races to go. In fact, he did become a world championship world champion with a title of 44 points. Pironi was second at 39 and John Watson third at 38. Although it must have been a very hollow victory, because if Didier Pironi had managed to win any of the races, he would have surely scored more than 5 points in the last five races. It's very much like a tale of the tortoise and the hare, with a naturally aspirated Williams winning over the turbocharge. In fact, Keke Rosberg only failed to finish in three races. In 1982, the USSR sent Venera 13, a spacecraft, and it landed on the surface of Venus. This was not the first craft to land on the surface of Venus, but it did set a new record for the time it spent operating on the surface. It survived for 2 hours 7 minutes before expiring and breaking. The Venera's spacecraft was a series of spacecraft sent by the USSR. In total, they sent a series of 16 vessels or crafts to Venus. Venera 4, spending 23 minutes in the Venus atmosphere before breaking, reaching a height of 23 meters. So why is it so hard to send a craft to Venus? Venus is called the Morning Star, and is considered to be the sister planet of the Earth, being of similar size. Yet one is white, blue and full of life, and the other has got a thick, dense atmosphere and no possible life at all. The atmosphere is in fact composed of 96% carbon dioxide and with very little water content at all. And this just traps any heat from the sun and just exacerbates it and makes it hotter and hotter. And it's not surprising that no craft can get to the surface of the Venus, because the surface of Venus is around 450 centigrade, or nearly 1,000 degrees Fahrenheit. With large sulfur dioxide in the atmosphere, it rains sulfur, and the surface of Venus is so high that it is 92 times the pressure of the Earth, and yet the two planets are so similar. But one can deflect the sun's rays and one can't, and the reason for this is because the Earth rotates on its axis once every 24 hours, and this causes a reaction, causes the molten core to produce a magnetic field, as opposed to Venus, whose spins one revolution every 240 days, and so it does not produce a magnetic field. I still think this is one of the great achievements of that year. I've waffled on a little bit longer than I wanted to talk about the Grand Prix, when there's another great story I wanted to talk about. I wanted to talk about Paolo Rossi. If you're Italian, you know who Paolo Rossi is. But if you don't, if you're not Italian, I'll tell you about him. Paolo Rossi is an Italian football player, and as a young 19-year-old in 1978, he was a top scorer in Division B, and this 24 goals in one season earned him the right to play for the World Cup for Italy in Argentina with an ageing Italian side. They did all right, and they did became fourth. For a bunch of old timers was all right, and one bright spark was Paolo Rossi scoring three goals. Everything was going great for Paolo until 1980, when he was caught up in the Padova betting scandal. His involvement is still disputed, but as a result he was banned from playing any professional football for 3 years. This was reduced to 2 years, and this means that he could come back 1 month before the 1982 World Cup. So with no football for 2 years, Bizzotti, the Italian manager, picked Paolo Rossi. And he picked him and played him in all three games of the first round of the World Cup. And he played like Italy played, terribly. The journalists called him the ghost, aimlessly wandering around the pitch without a clue. And having said this, they managed to scrape through to the second round of the World Cup. They scored two goals, while Cameroon only managed to score one. But in the second round, they were up against the world champions Argentina and Brazil. For some reason, Italy and Rossi's fortune changed, and in the first round against Argentina, they beat Argentina 2-1. Rossi given 10 stars by the journalists, and in the very next game, Rossi scored a hat-trick in a thrilling 3-2 win over Brazil, and onto the semi-finals and against Poland, and Rossi scores a brace or two to beat Poland 2-0, and this whirlwind then carries on until the final against West Germany, and Rossi scores again to help Italy win a very unlikely World Cup title.